Welcome to FemTech at Work, the podcast where we explore the intersection of technology, health, and women's empowerment in the workplace, hosted by me, Maaike Steinebach. This show will dive into the innovative solutions transforming women's health and well-being in the workplace. Join us as we chat with FemTech founders, industry leaders, and change makers who are pioneering advancements in FemTech and women's health. We discuss everything: menstrual health, reproductive rights, menopause, but also the challenges women face in the workplace and how innovation can overcome them. Whether you're a seasoned professional or just starting your FemTech journey, FemTech at Work is here to inspire and inform you about the future of health and wellness for women everywhere. Tune in and be part of the conversation. Hi, and welcome on today's episode of FemTech at Work with a very, very special guest, the co-founder of Antivorte Labs, Annie Ho. Hi, Annie. Welcome to today's episode.
Hi, everyone. Hi, Maaike. Thank you for having me here.
So excited to have you. Let's jump right in. So tell me a little bit about your background and what can you tell me about your journey to starting your company?
My background is actually in psychology. I've studied psychology both in my undergraduate as well as in master's. And because I have my family business, so on the maternal side in traditional Chinese medicine, so I also got interested in how I can incorporate TCM practices into women's well-being in particular. And hence, that's why I started the brand Antivorte with my co-founder, Sarah Jane Ho, in order to produce, develop products that can really help women navigate all the challenges in their lives.
Amazing. So you mentioned, obviously, your family background in TCM, but what inspired you to specifically focus on women's health and intimate care? It's kind of a subsection of a subsection, right?
I know it's kind of like a niche, and we've had quite a debate internally about whether we want to be so niche as opposed to, you know, like a broader category like our beauty or cosmetics. But for us, we really feel like we want to have this intimate relationship with the customers upfront. And where do you start in an intimate relationship is you start from the most intimate part in your body. We also want to make sure that we are not competing with a lot of big brands who've already made it with big budgets. And so as a founder, strategically, we wanted to select a niche that we think that we have a chance in really owning the niche and also starting off with a very loyal and intimate relationship with our customers. That's why we picked this sub-niche of the intimate care.
Tell me, what does Antivorte Labs do?
Antivorte is an intimate skincare brand that is rooted in traditional Chinese medicine. So we have products such as the cleansing gel, the wipes, as well as the spray, that is well pH balanced and free of all the fragrances and harmful chemicals such as alcohol or phthalates, sulfates.
Maybe for people that don't know that much about traditional Chinese medicine, how does that work differently in your products than maybe conventional products?
It's more about the philosophy of building your product. So when we think about traditional Chinese medicine, we don't actually think about curing a disease or curing an illness. We think about it in terms of lifestyle habits that can help you prevent further illnesses or help you achieve homeostasis with your body as a system, as well as with the environment. So when we are incorporating or developing our products, we try to put in more of the TCM herbs, traditional Chinese medicinal herbs that we know can help women achieve more harmony. So some of these herbs that we use are dandelion, honeysuckle flower. Given that what we know about the herbal properties and what these herbs were previously used in traditional Chinese medicine, we feel that these herbs incorporated into intimate care products could help women feel better in their own skin.
Ah, that's amazing. So when you started your first products, what was your thinking or the process around developing that product?
We first of all had a product concept. So when we had the product concept, before we went into the actual product development, we started to do focus groups with some of our key target audience, which is women of age 35 and above. And so we did focus group, and then we asked them if they might be interested in trying a product such as the one that we presented We gathered some feedback, some consumer insights, as well as their lifestyle habits. And then we started to do kind of like put together the formulation. We started to source into different manufacturers to see whether there's a good fit. And then we had the initial sample. We actually did a test launch in China for 2 months just to let the products, you know, start selling organically for about 2 months. And then we decided to stop everything. So we stopped the selling operations and then we started to adjust the product. So we used an actual small market launch, kind of like a soft launch to test product market fit. And then coming back to make all the product adjustments, including packaging, including formulation, including messaging, as well as, you know, all the pricing strategy before we decided to launch officially. And then when we launched officially, we chose the US market as the place to launch officially.
Ah, interesting. So now I have a lot of questions. When you did your focus groups, did you do them in China or in the US?
We did them in China, but in the US market, we did them online. So we used kind of like MailChimp, kind of like a survey tool to help us collect quantitative data for the US market.
And was there any differences kind of that surprised you or similarities or outcomes? Because obviously two very different markets, particularly in the approach to TCM, right?
There are some differences. So first of all, like the China market is very familiar with TCM approaches. So we actually do not really need to do any education. Whereas in the US market, actually people were a little bit confused about what TCM could offer to them. There was some sort of confusion about whether it's medicine or not. So we did have to do more of that communication. And secondly, I have noticed that in the US, there is a movement towards what they call like pro-aging. They are embracing their aging process. And people such as celebrities are also being very open about, you know, their perimenopausal and menopausal symptoms. Whereas in the Asia side of things, people are still more in the stage of anti-aging. So women typically are still in that preventative spec. So we don't want to age. We don't want to embrace aging at all. We want to deny aging, right? We want to go against time. So many beauty brands, like their brand slogans is about stopping time or going against time, as opposed to really embracing time. So I think those mentality, like between the two cultures, are still quite different. So in the US, our messaging has been more about how do we help you navigate premenopausal and menopausal stages. And then whereas in Asia, our messaging is going to be more about how do we help you prevent the aging process.
Okay, a lot of great insights as well. I love this kind of anti-aging and pro-aging. So why did you decide to launch in the US first versus China or Asia?
On two parts. So my co-founder, Sarah Jane Ho, so she's also a host for a Netflix show called Mind Your Manners, as well as the author of the same book. So the show and the book actually performed quite well in the US market. So we also decided that because social media is going to be a very important aspect of our marketing tool, and also it's going to be kind of our advantage against other competitor brands. So we decided to pick US as kind of like our first market to launch. At the same time, we also made it quite clear from the start that our strategy to build is to build like a global brand. A brand that is rooted in traditional Chinese medicine, Chinese like oriental aspects, but that have made it in the West as well. We want to be identified as a brand that is also present in New York, in Paris, in all the, you know, key cities in the world. So therefore, we feel that for an Asian brand, we have to first establish ourselves in one of the, you know, big Western markets before we can come back and then to reestablish ourselves as a premium global international brand.
Yeah, that's a very, very smart idea, I have to say. And I really think the intimate care market is having a massive moment. You're seeing projections of multi-billion dollars and then combination with TCM, as you mentioned, not just our celebrities embracing perimenopause and menopause, but they're also embracing TCM, right? It may be in a different way than the products you're offering, but they're talking about gua sha, they're talking about cupping. So it all sounds like it's a very smooth journey, right? You know, you did your focus groups, you did your feedback, you found your manufacturers, you launched in the US, but I'm pretty sure you had some challenges along the way. What were kind of the challenges that you had?
We have challenges. I feel that as a brand founder, sometimes we do have a tendency to be over-optimistic because we feel our products are so great. People should just come to us. But that's not really the case, because when you're actually selling the market, your products are sitting there, like, you know, amongst so many other products, right? And then customers nowadays, they're bombarded with a lot of brand messages. So it's very difficult for us to, even if we have the best products, our return rate is close to zero. And then we have like great customer satisfaction. So our products are there. But it's all about how do we make people who don't know about us know about us, right? So then the amount of money or the amount of budget that have to be allocated to building awareness, I feel like is much more than we originally envisioned.
Yeah, that's interesting. And because you have to put in a disproportionate amount of upfront money to kind of convince people to buy your product. How are you finding the social media platform? So obviously the intimate care markets could potentially run into censorship in certain markets. Are you finding the platforms that you use supportive of your business?
I don't actually think censorship is a big issue, but I do think that many influencers, when we try to seek out people to work with us, are a little bit hesitant about being associated with intimate care products. I don't think it's because they don't use it, but it's because they don't really want to be talking about it. And there's still some taboo around discussion of the intimate area. And even when we are speaking to our friends and family members, some of them would be questioning about why do we want to share so much private details with others? And because my co-founder and me, in order to push our brand upfront, so we also need to be in front of the camera talking about our own vignettes and personal experiences. And sometimes like people might think it is a bit weird. Like, why do we want to tell people like about our most sensitive topics? Why don't we just keep it private? But the problem is if you keep it private, then people don't know about your product. Yeah. So that's kind of like where I feel kind of like the more challenges are like in terms of communication rather than messaging censorship per se. It's more about taboo.
Yeah. And do you feel that taboo is bigger in Asia than in the US, or are you finding that it's the same level of taboo everywhere?
I think it's both. Even in the US, originally I was thinking, okay, so maybe in the West, you are more open given all the DEI movements. However, it's actually not the case. It really depends on which state you are in. And then even within the US, I guess like people are also quite divided in terms of what they think is right or wrong.
Yeah, so I'm from Europe and I'm always surprised to see some topics are discussed very, very openly when it's about intimacy. And I'm like, oh my God, you know, this is maybe not things that we need to talk about or need to know about. I'm even flustered about this. But then other topics which seem so natural and so common seem so hard to talk about. But I have to say, in my experience, particularly also in China, I feel that Chinese women are very open, very interested to explore new things, very interested to try new things as well. Did you have that experience in your focus groups as well?
Yes. Most women that we spoke to, they are willing to try, as you said. I think in China, as opposed to in the States, is the other way. Like the social media is a censorship issue. Like green, red, they're very strict about the words that you can say. Like you cannot say sex, for example, but it's so weird because sex is just sex. Like, why do you have to make more of it, right? And then it's not vulgar. It's not meant to be vulgar. We should embrace it, right?
But then it's the only thing that brought us all here, right? So that's so interesting.
Yeah. Yes. But in China, it is a censorship issue. Yeah, as opposed to, you know, the taboo. People want to talk about it, but they're not able to really talk about it given all of the censorship.
Yes, exactly. So coming back to the platform. So you talked a little bit about Douyin and Xiaohongshu, and are you also now, you see in the US, you know, the potential of moving off TikTok potentially? Are you using all these platforms? Instagram, TikTok, Xiaohongshu, Douyin, all of them?
So what's interesting is that in the US, we were quite strong in Instagram and Facebook to start with because of Sarah Jane's followers are mostly on Instagram. We tried to launch TikTok without much success. I also think that probably because TikTok has a much more younger audience, whereby our brand is more geared towards women who are more mature. So perhaps TikTok, but in the beginning, it just didn't have the right audience for us. So we actually stopped TikTok before the TikTok ban, which is good. We only did it for a few months and then we just figured it wasn't working out. So we concentrated most of our efforts on Instagram and on Facebook in the US. in the future, we might look into launching our YouTube channel, because I think with the TCM aspect of the brand, as well as image here, more like long form videos that are more educational might be helpful for our brand. And then in Asia, we have Red. We actually just have Red. We actually did not really do Douyin for a while because Douyin, there was just too much censorship. So we actually stopped doing our Douyin account, but we still kept our Red. And in fact, when we entered into China through cross-border e-commerce 2 months ago, we picked Red as our first starting point.
Yeah, and so far so good on Red, because I feel a lot of the US buyers are now also moving on to Red.
Yeah, I think in Red, we have a better product market fit. So with the audience, and also as you mentioned, like I think the Red audience is more international. So they do recognize more about us as a, like a global brand. They're more used to we're a cross-border brand and not a local brand. So I think Red is overall like a good starting point for us.
And are there any particular kind of rules and regulations that you had to adhere to as a TCM intimate care brand versus, let's say, a non-TCM brand? Is it harder? Is it the same? Is it different? How does that work?
In terms of compliance, so regulatory is a big thing for us. So we need to make sure that our brand is compliant. And we are FDA registered, as well as, you know, Canada Health and we registered and all that. So when we did the registration, I think because some of the herbs that we used, they're not like standard ingredients. So we did have to provide more justifications in terms of the safety documents, which is all good because our quality check is pretty good. So we were able to meet all the standards. Aside from that, we just need to make sure that when we're making the claims, because we are sitting inside the cosmetic category. So although it's TCM, and then so we do know that anti-heat means anti-inflammation. We cannot say we're anti-inflammation. A lot of the herbs that we are using, they have natural antimicrobial or antiviral properties. That's why we use them. But we cannot communicate those properties. Everything we communicate still needs to sit within our product category, which is by and large the cosmetic category. So I think that means that when we're communicating the herbs, I think in Asia, people do understand. They understand, you know, what chrysanthemum can do, what Japanese honeysuckle flower can do. But then when you're in the US, then you have to transfer, oh, okay, so what does anti-heat mean? Without saying the words inflammation, without saying the words antimicrobial, how can you say it? So I think that kind of communication becomes a little bit more non-direct in terms of the claims.
Yeah, that's a big, I can understand. That's a bit of a challenge. And you spoke earlier about education. What are your thoughts about how we can educate the globe more about some of the products that you're using?
We have written a very beautiful editorial section on our website. Unfortunately, I've noticed that people are going more directly to the products rather than editorial pages. So we do probably have to incorporate more of our educational message directly linked to the products. At the same time, Sarah Jane and myself, we're spending a lot of our time participating in webinars like this, as well as in live streams, and as well as the media interviews, just so that we can do more of that education. But I think education also takes time. It's not as direct as, oh, you know, come by and receive a 20% promotion. It's just simply not as direct as that. But based on psychological principles, once people feel they're in the education process and they have the buy-in, the loyalty goes far more longer. So we are putting more efforts to education. It's just that it takes more time.
If you look kind of at the overall market, I'm sure you keep an eye out on just women's health and the intimate care market. What are you seeing in terms of general trends?
I think AI is a big trend. I think it is the same, but the AI adoption for women is actually quite low. I was actually just reading some stats like before this meeting. I think only around 40% of women of our age is incorporating AI like into our day-to-day life. I do think that for any industry, as well as, you know, the intimate care, like we need to think also about how we can leverage on some of the AI tools in the market. For example, in terms of education. So if customers are asking some question, rather than customer service, like being able to know all that knowledge, like can we incorporate like an AI tool into that customer interface so that all their messages are more accurate to start with and then plus more comprehensive? Can we incorporate AI to help filter out our customers so that we have the more detailed customer segmentation? So that when we do retargeting, it's more targeted towards customers' real purchase habits or, you know, lifestyle behaviors. So it's, I think we just need to incorporate more of those tools into the way that we are looking at our business, as well as analysis and follow-up.
Yeah. And I think I agree. I think that although there is a lot of bubble at the moment around AI as well, and I think particularly for the business and the industry we are in, women's health, there is still a lot of gender bias, because if you're not self-training your AI, the data will not necessarily have a lot of input from women. But I think there's one other element where it would be very useful and where I'm seeing other companies use it is for product development. So to your point, in the precision medicine space where I think we are going, so that everybody has a tailor-made product for their skin, for their bodies, for their heart, et cetera, using the insights from AI to actually create different products, I think would also be really interesting. What do you have in mind in terms of your five-year roadmap? I know you've only just started and you have an amazing range already, but hey, let's talk a little bit about the future.
Okay, so we have a very complete product universe. We are just waiting to recuperate more cash before we can develop more products. So our next in line is going to be supplements. We do want to develop some oral supplements to complement the skin products that we're developing. We had wanted to develop a lube that is infused with traditional Chinese medicine herbs. A lot of the women that we spoke to, dryness is actually one of their key symptoms. And I think it really bothers a lot of women. But the lubes on the market, a lot of them are actually not very natural. We do want to create like a lube product. We have other products in mind, like for example, aromatherapy, right? So there's a lot of essential oils that are used at the current moment. Most of the essential oils are floral-based, are actually not leaf or herb-based. So, but actually in China or in Asia, we have this thing called a TCM oil. So it's oils that is made from TCM herbs. So we do also want to develop some of these aroma-related products that have like TCM properties. So these are just some ideas that we have in the back of pocket and that we're actually quite ready to really formally develop them. At the same time, we also want to improve the scientific credentials behind all of our products. So going into more, like we do have clinical trials, but then we want to do another round of clinical trials with a larger sample base. We want to collaborate with universities, even publish or participate in some peer-reviewed journal articles so that we can improve the overall scientific basis for our products. Otherwise, some people will question, you know, the validity of TCM. And even when, for example, now, like we're speaking at QVC and that we have to establish the claims that we're making, like we also need more of that clinical trial stuff to help support in the future.
Yeah, I feel a lot more critical consumers want science-based solutions, but thankfully they're also doing these kind of clinical trials and collaborating with universities is actually becoming easier too. So yeah, very excited to hear about that. You touched briefly on funding, right? I guess for those of you that don't know or listening out this podcast, globally, only around 3% of VC investment actually goes to startups in the women's health space. So the upside is enormous, but it also means that the challenges for founders are quite real. And I know you have had quite a positive funding journey so far, right? Can you talk a little bit about that?
I'm very thankful that some of our key funds for our seed round did believe in us. So the funding that we received was pre-product. And then, like you mentioned, they're one of the few VCs that are supporting the cost of feminine intimate care in particular. We've actually spoken to a lot of potential investors. Not all of them are equally invested in developing women's driven businesses. And so many of them are actually concerned with developing just pure FMCG brands, as opposed to, you know, something that is more related to tech, which is a big topic right now.
Yeah, or B2B. I also read in a report the other day that more investors, particularly in the West, see the difficulty in monetizing a B2C business and are focusing more on B2B business, which I guess for your products is going to be a little bit hard to do at this point in time. But yeah.
B2C brands are quite tough at the moment, yeah, in terms of investment.
But I'm an optimist by nature. So I'm very hopeful that when investors see the beauty of your brand, the story, the branding, which is beautiful, the product line, which is very well needed, and probably most importantly, the fact that consumers are actually excited about it and are buying it, combined with women's health and menopause having a bit of momentum, fingers crossed for 2025 for the year of women's health. I think we're almost done, and then I'll let you go on your way for your family. But maybe just one final question. What advice would you give other entrepreneurs that are interested in the women's health and intimate care space?
I think there's so many advice. I don't know which one to start with.
No, I just start.
For me personally, for my own personal journey in starting a brand, I feel one of the most critical aspects is whether you found the right partner to do it with you. I don't think starting a business by yourself, like solo, is very easy. I think it's very important to find a highly trusting partner to work with you on it. And then so that you can have conflicts, you can have sparks, debates, and also check-ins, and you're not in it by yourself. I think this partnership is very important for starting a business. And then also, I think getting the buy-in of your family members, especially since you're going into the intimate care category, I think your family members need to be supportive of it as well. Like, they cannot be dissing you all the time about why you're doing this. And they need supportive. And I think, thankfully, I also have that as well as part of my journey.
Amazing. Yeah, I agree with you. I think being a solo founder can be very lonely. And if you can't find the right co-founder, in any case, find a community where you can connect with other founders and like-minded people so that you at least have a platform or a place where you can vent or spar or just share some of your challenges on your journey. I think super important. And I think the other point that you mentioned about getting the support from your family and friends, I hear a lot about the success of founders, whether they are male or female, but having a supportive partner or family, you know, makes a whole lot of difference because this is a 24/7 thing. So if you don't have that support 24/7, then, you know, it becomes really, really hard. Well, Annie, thank you so much for being on this podcast. I really wish you and Sarah Jane all the best of success. Really excited to hear how things are going and how you are looking at different ways of bringing TCM into the intimate care and women's health space. So thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And I love to check in with everybody, you know, let's say 1 year from now to see how we progressed.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, so far I have interviewed probably around 20 founders from the region and I'll be moving on more into Southeast Asia soon.
Okay.
So yeah, it's a great idea to reconnect with everybody to see how they're doing. In the meantime, for all the listeners, if you enjoyed this episode, please like and review so that more subscribers and more people can actually listen to these amazing founders like Annie. Annie, thank you very much. Happy Chinese New Year. And thank you so much for being on my show.
Thank you. Happy New Year to everybody.